Hi, Janina.
Hi, Emma.
How you doing?
I'm not bad. How are you?
I'm all right. I'm okay. I'm living life, enjoying the brief amount of sunshine that's happening in Northern Ireland right now.
Oh, yeah. Yep. Yeah.
Yeah, I've grappled with some French history for about a week, and I'm high on chaos, frankly.
I mean, that is fair. It is chaotic.
The French, man.
Yeah,
French.
I mean, but we should all learn a lesson from the French. If you're not happy, take to the streets. Every day there's something in the news that makes me think, why have we not taken to the streets? We should be more French.
What I've learned is that the French will have a revolution over virtually anything.
Oh, yeah.
And that they now have a good 300-year history of revolting. And the English had, like, one revolt and then were like, oh, no, sorry, God. Just put it back the way it was and we'll all go back to the beginning again.
Yeah.
And then never had another one.
I think it's time we tried again, honestly.
Yeah. So they're 300 years ahead of us. We've got a lot of catching up to do. Taking to the barricades goes. Yeah. So we're Emma and Janina. This is History and Sexy.
Yeah. We answer your history questions, which I feel like we haven't actually outlined the premise of the show last few episodes.
That thing. That's what we do.
We research the history that you can't be bothered researching yourselves.
Yeah, or that it's too complicated, because this one was quite complicated. And honestly, I do not blame anybody from trying to understand the French. This episode, we are answering a question from Julian Cosson, who said, how big a dickhead was Napoleon III?
I'm so far coming down on the side of exactly the same amount of dick that I would be if I were a dictator.
So, if you want to know what Janina would be like if you let her have power... then it seems like this is it.
I mean, it's a taste. I would do more. I would, for example, ban bicycles from... Like, not ban bicycles. I would make bicycles obey the road rules.
You've just alienated so many people, yeah.
I hate London bicyclists. Bicyclists in New Zealand are a delight, but in London they don't obey the road rules. I have been so many times I've been nearly hit by a bicycle when I'm crossing a pedestrian crossing.
This is great. Because my only thing is that I would make it illegal to have films that are over 90 minutes long.
That's fair. That is also fair. I would also make you... I wouldn't actually... Like, there is a lot I would do if I was a dictator that is good. Most of it would be good. But I would consider requiring some sort of license to be a pedestrian in central London.
You have to pass a test.
Yeah. That's the tiny fascist corner of my soul is that I honestly think that you should be expected to have some sort of spatial awareness when you're out in public.
Yeah. Fairly specific, but fair enough.
All the rest of my reforms would be very, very socialist in nature, but that one thing would be like, no.
And that would be what brought you down. That would be rampant opposition to the pedestrian licensing laws that would destroy your rule.
Everyone would be totally fine with like the criminal justice reforms and the free education and all of that sort of stuff. And then they would balk at being expected to look where they are going.
The really intense law tests that were around pedestrians that had to be renewed on a yearly basis.
When you are a drama kid, as I was, one of the exercises you do to warm up, essentially, is you just like walk really quickly in a straight line across the room and you just turn. And the idea is that there'll be like a whole group of you in a small room walking as fast as you can and you're not allowed to walk into each other. And I think that it is so good for people and everyone should be forced to do that every day while they're teenagers, just so you develop some sort of awareness of your body in space and what else is around it.
Okay. Yeah. All right. That seems reasonable.
That's that done. Yeah. We should talk about something to the purpose, which is not me, in my opinion.
Napoleon III did not do that. So the period that we are talking about is the period from kind of the last half of the 19th century. And this kind of deeply chaotic period of French history, in which Napoleon III, whose name is Charles-Louis Napoleon Bonaparte, is what he calls himself, who is the nephew of that Napoleon Bonaparte, mm-hmm. like the one who is just been the star of one of the funniest films I've ever seen in my entire life.
I haven't watched it yet. 3 million hour epic
Napoleon. Have you not seen it?
Not yet. No, we were going to watch it the other night, but then something came up and we couldn't. But
it's so long. It makes no sense.
This is one thing that will be outlawed when I'm in charge. It does genuinely bug me that the casting of Napoleon and Josephine really pisses me off, because Josephine was 8 years older than Napoleon.
Yeah. Yes, but the casting of the whole thing makes no sense. It has a surprising amount of people from British sitcoms in the 90s in it.
Outstanding.
Including the actor Kevin Eldon, which made me scream. And yeah, it's just deeply bizarre. I highly recommend it.
Yep.
After I saw it, me and my friend Innes spent about 3 weeks just going up to each other and shouting, "Destiny brought me this lamb chop," which is a genuine line in the film and is very, very good.
The line that tipped Jamie over into wanting to watch it at all was the one about, "Of course you think you're special, you've got both."
Yes. Yes. You think you're so special because you've got boats. Yeah, the whole thing is glorious. But yeah,
absolutely.
This is his nephew, mm-hmm. the son of his younger brother, who is King of Holland. And he grows up as basically brought up as Napoleon's heir and believing that he is the embodiment of Napoleonic glory and destiny. Mm-hmm. At the point at which, so Napoleon is defeated in 1815 after what's called the Hundred Days, when he is exiled. Elba escapes from Elba, goes back to France, leads a revolution, overthrows the king again, then gets defeated at the Battle of Waterloo by kind of allied European forces, and then is re-exiled to St. Helena. And then King Louis the 18th is put back on the throne. So that all happens. King Louis the 18th is then the king until 1824. He's replaced by his heir. Then in 1830, there is another revolution. This is not a revolution to overthrow monarchy, but just to overthrow that specific king.
Mm-hmm. Which is fair enough. If you don't like him, get rid.
So the House of Bourbon is overthrown and replaced with Louis Philippe of the House of Orléans. Mm-hmm. And that they tried to institute a constitutional monarchy, which lasts for a little while until 1848, when there is another revolution.
There were a lot of revolutions in 1848. This is the year when everyone was doing it.
And that this is the one that started it. So the 1848 February Revolution is the one that started. There was a whole book that came out last year about all the revolutions of 1848.
Yeah. The textbook, I did a paper on revolutions in university, and the textbook that we were working from just had a chapter called 1848. It was just all of them. It's a great time.
Yeah, it was a big year.
Yeah.
But this one is the Second Republican Revolution, where the French overthrew monarchy again and installed a second republic with a new constitution. And this new constitution introduced the revolutionary idea of universal male suffrage. So everybody could have a vote. Mm-hmm. And the plan was that they would have a parliament and they would have a president. There was going to be like two houses and there was going to be a president. And that president would rule for a 4-year term and then they would never be able to run again and it would be replaced every time. And it was all very kind of idealistic and delightful that this is what was going to happen. They had an interim government that is going to oversee everything until the president is elected in December. Unfortunately, the person that gets elected is Louis Napoleon Bonaparte, who becomes the first president of the Second Republic.
Who is very popular, in part because there are still loads of Bonapartists around, but also because he's very big on workers' rights. And like,
he's yes, so he has been going around for years, pretty much his entire life, aiming to be in charge of France. That is his whole goal.
Yeah.
He has attempted to invade France twice, once in 1839 and once in 1840. Both times he attempted to do what Napoleon had done, which is just rock up on the shores of France.
And hence all the people welcome you so aggressively that you end up winning France.
Exactly. You roll up with like 50 people and you say, "Napoleon is back." And everybody goes, "Yeah." And then they march you to Paris. And both times he turned up and said, "Napoleon is back." And everyone went, "What?" And he was immediately arrested. And he had spent most of his life kind of not in France. He almost never was in France. He was in London. He was in America for a while, but brought up in Germany.
Because he was exiled for being part of the Napoleonic dynasty at all. So
they do not want him.
No.
So he hangs out mostly in London, occasionally in Germany and Austria. And he, from there, he writes a great many books, which is where he kind of has been laying out his ideals. He writes them and then publishes them in France. So he wrote one called Reverie Politique in 1832, just political reveries. Sounds fun. One which was just a critique of the Swiss.
Fair enough.
One on kind of a manual of army reform called Manuel d'Artillerie. So basically like how you should run an army. Mm-hmm. And then in 1839, he's got a big one, which is called Des Idées Napoléon, which are his Napoleonic ideas, mm-hmm. like what he thinks Napoleonic dynasty stands for, what he thinks the Napoleonic idea was. Mm-hmm. So he says, the Napoleonic idea is that of reconstituting French society upset by 50 years of revolution, of reconciling order with liberty, the rights of the people with the principle of authority. This is the bit that makes him unpopular. In the midst of divided parties, of which one sees only the past and the other only the future, it takes ancient forms and new principles. Desiring a solid foundation, its system rests on the principles of eternal justice, and it tramples underfoot the reactionary theories which are born of party excesses. It replaces the hereditary system of old aristocracies by a system of hierarchy, which, while it assures equality, rewards merit and guarantees order.
Yeah, it finds but me, because of my descent and who I am, what family I belong to, should be in charge of it.
Uh-huh. Guarantees order is a thing that comes to be really important. It finds in democracy an element of strength and stability because it regulates it. It finds an element of strength in liberty because it prepares its reign wisely by laying broad foundations before raising the edifice. It follows neither the wavering steps of the party nor the passions of the mob. It commands through reason and guides because it goes first. Mm-hmm. So that's the one that he published, basically saying that Napoleonic ideal is kind of a strong man at the centre.
Yeah.
Who will stand above politics, stand above excess, stand above everything else, and will allow both democracy, but also by kind of not really having it, by having an authoritarian centre.
Yeah. Which, and like, the thing is, it's one of those things that if you imagine, which obviously he did because he thought it was him, that it is possible for one person, for anyone to ever attain that level of power without being corrupted by politics, then sure. But a perfect great leader who can just make everything good. That's literally what everyone wants. But that person doesn't exist, which is why we have to have the next best thing, which is democracy.
Yeah, basically. But he believes that it is possible. And
he believes that it is him.
He believes that government should be quite activist, but he believes that it's necessary to have a great man at the centre of any kind of democracy. And he's like, you have Caesar, who he wrote a biography of. You have
great
Alexander the
Great.
Yeah. If you know anything about these people, then you wouldn't want to follow them. But he's basically like, look, there was Alexander the Great, there was Julius Caesar, there was Charlemagne, there was my uncle, and now there's me.
Yeah.
And we will solve all your problems.
Megalomaniacs think that other megalomaniacs were great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then he is, after his second coup attempt, at which he gave quite a great speech after he was arrested, because he was arrested like instantly and tried for attempting to invade France. And he gave a speech in which he basically outlined what he stood for. And like, these are the kind of things that make him super popular, which is, he says, the principle is the sovereignty of the people. The cause is the empire. The defeat is Waterloo. You acknowledge the principle, you serve the cause, and for the defeat, it is now for you to avenge it.
Oh.
And basically places himself as the return of Napoleon post-Waterloo, and everything is going to be okay. He's imprisoned for 6 years, during which time, and this is quite impressive, he manages to father 2 children.
That is impressive.
Yeah. So it can't have been that. Yeah. And the main thing that he does other than shagging is he writes a book called The Extinction of Poverty, in which he basically says that he kind of invents this utopian idea, or doesn't invent, but develops this utopian idea of promoting agricultural colonies to create work for people, of higher wages for people within the cities. Basically, the idea is a fairly strong government intervention in creating camps of people to work on a kind of abandoned land and then be able to earn ownership of that land through work, and which is overseen by the military, but then also giving higher wages in the cities in order to encourage people to also work in the cities. And it's kind of unworkable, but it shows, but it's super popular. Like, this book and Napoleonic Ideas just sell thousands and thousands of copies.
Yeah. And the idea that, like, the government is responsible for the population as a whole's ability to make a living is a good one, but it's not a, but then you have to have a solution that's a little bit more based in reality.
Yes. He describes himself as a socialist, repeatedly describes himself as a socialist, and as believing that the responsibility of the state is to protect everybody. And that the state has a very strong responsibility to its people.
Yeah.
Which is something that the conservatives who absolutely despise him, like the monarchist conservatives, do not like at all.
Of course they don't. Because conservatism in its nature is about retaining traditional values that include keeping wealth and power consolidated amongst the elite. That's the point of it.
It is, and he does not really seem to believe in that.
No. He believes in himself having power, but...
Yeah, he believes primarily...
but not anywhere else.
If he believes in anything, as far as I can tell, it is very much in the concept of Napoleon as something greater than everything else.
Yes, but it is, like, which is obviously nonsense, but it is refreshing to have that filtered through, like, because he is this great godlike figure, he has a massive responsibility to everyone else. Like, that's not how this sort of attitude normally goes.
It's not. And you people who do coups are, well, spoilers for what's coming up, but are doing it so that they can kind of enrich themselves, which he very much does not seem to have done, which is good.
Yeah.
But he very much, you know, he writes at one point that, "I believe in fate. If my body has miraculously escaped danger, if my soul has managed to overcome every obstacle, it is because I have been called upon to achieve something of significance."
Mm.
Which is megalomaniac speaking.
But. Absolutely. It's also survivorship bias. It's you're here because of coincidence. It's fine.
Yeah. So he got his 2 failed coups. He then escapes from prison by waiting, just out of boredom, essentially, by waiting until they are doing some renovations on the prison, picking up a bit of wood and walking out.
Yep, fair.
And within 12 hours, he was in England and no one ever did anything about the fact that he had just escaped from prison, because about 6 months or so after he escaped from prison, they had the February Revolution, and he immediately went back to France and offered his services to the provisional government. And they were like, "What the fuck? Why are you here?" go away, and sent him back to England. And he then returned when the elections were happening, first got himself elected as a minister, and then when the presidential elections happened in 1848, he swept the board and won 74% of the vote.
Yeah, which is just a wild majority.
It is a wild majority. It is a huge amount of the vote.
Isn't
that he
gets. Like 75% of the vote, and that it's still a majority, even if you factor in people who didn't vote? Like, it's 55% of all eligible big voters, including abstentions.
Yeah, because they have a huge turnout. Like, at one point, one of the books I was like, it was a low turnout for this election. Only 65% of people voted. But this is the first election that, or the first. There have been, like, previous ministerial elections, but this is the first election for a president. And this is also the first election where every man has been allowed to vote. Like, there's no property qualifications, there's no qualifications as to who is allowed to vote. If you're a man and you're a citizen, you're allowed to vote, which is a very big step forward.
Yeah.
And he wins 74%, which is a lot of votes.
Yeah.
And then is the president for 4 years, during which time people don't love him particularly. the political elite who surround him, who have kind of set up this new republic, they are very split between kind of various types of republicanism. And then you have a lot of conservatives who are still around, people who are still very Bourbonist, people who are still very Orleanist, people who are kind of split between what they want. And they all think that he is a twerp. He's kind of short and a bit funny looking. And he's not very kind of high energy person. He kind of has cosmopolitan ennui.
Mm-hmm.
It's what it's described as by one person. So he doesn't get up very early. He insists upon having 1 to 3 p.m. every day as his shagging time.
This is iconic behavior. We should all be taking a leaf out of his book. Don't get up early and then shag in the early afternoon every day.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which means that the kind of conservative politicians around him think that they will be able to lead him, essentially. They think that he will just be an inexperienced, useless, overprivileged lump of an oversexed, over here kind of guy. Mm-hmm. That one of them says, we will give him women and we will lead him. And they think that they will be able to, like, force him into doing whatever they want.
Mm.
And it turns out that they wildly underestimate his belief in himself.
Yeah.
Because he has no party, he has no friends, so he just sort of gathers together people who like him and who he likes, and immediately starts cracking down on absolutely everybody and using the military to enforce the things that he thinks are important. He immediately uses the military against the assembly, the parliament. Whenever they bother him, he's like, all right, well, I'll shoot you in the fucking head. He has what seems to be a kind of a very strong sense of what he wants, and refuses to be, like, really refuses to be led by other people. And at one point he writes this letter to people that are his own friends and says that, I will never ever be influenced by somebody else, and the more you try to influence me, the less I'm going to do what you want. Like, I will take your advice.
That is being influenced by someone. It's just being influenced by them in a contrarian manner.
True, but he basically says, look, I'll take your advice, but if I don't think it's a good idea, I'm not going to do it.
Yeah.
I will only ever be directed by my sense of purpose and by my heart, and your advice is useful, but don't think that you can talk me into stuff that I don't want to do, essentially.
Yeah.
But what he wants to do is consolidate his power and maintain order. The party of order is what he says he is creating, and order becomes kind of his watchword. And much as with a lot of people who say they are maintaining order, quote unquote, this often means kind of very brutal crackdowns. He wants liberalisation eventually, but he believes that there, as he said, there needs to be, in his conception, a foundation of order whereby everybody is kind of doing as they're told, and people are not. And, you know, there have been enough revolutions in France and enough miniature revolutions, some of which he attempted to lead, that you can see why he feels that there needs to be really intense repression and censorship in order to eliminate all opposition.
Mm.
But it is not enormously popular, because he institutes kind of fairly severe censorship immediately, bans the congregation of more than 20 people. The assembly, although he manages to distance himself from this fairly successfully, the assembly immediately repeal universal male suffrage.
Yeah.
Forcing people have to prove that they have lived at the same address for 3 years, which basically just cuts out your entire rural population.
Yeah.
And anyone who has moved in the past 3 years. You can't have a criminal record, and they kind of employ a poll tax as well.
Mm.
which removes 30% of the electorate immediately. But he also allows lots of kind of random arrests and brutal repression of any protests. He will send the army in against them. He gives lots of speeches where he says kind of very populist, borderline fascist things like, good men should be reassured by my rule and bad men should be very afraid. Leaving a lot of room for interpretation in good and bad. But he's very keen that he will be bringing order to France and will be stopping any protests and stopping constant revolutions right up until 1851, when his term comes to an end. He is legally barred from having another term. He briefly tried to get some constitutional rules changed so that he could have another term, but everybody was very resistant. They quite liked the idea of the one-term president situation.
Everyone. I think I read that he did get a majority of support in the assembly, but not a supermajority, which is what you needed to change the constitution. Yeah.
But nobody was mad keen on it. But he did not pass it. And so he overthrew his own government in a military coup. Yeah.
I just before we get into his imperial reign, I do think it's nice to just touch on the fact that he also insisted on being called the Prince President
when
he was president. Which is
He does.
Which is hilarious.
Yeah. The Prince President. Just in case you forgot who he was.
Yeah.
And he does manage to, like, he's very big on kind of personal propaganda. Like, he republishes his own books constantly and then, like, publishes extracts of them and starts, like, celebrating his own birthday as an important day pretty much immediately. And then, as I say, overthrows himself.
Yep.
And thus becomes both the first and last president of the Second Republic. And the first and last emperor of the Second Empire.
Yeah.
And he does it semi-bloodlessly, largely because he is in charge of the army already.
Yeah.
And so the day before, he just has a load of people arrested preemptively. He spent the kind of 6 months before putting his own family members and loyalists into kind of key positions of the government. So he's made a friend of his in charge of the military. His half-brother is the Minister of the Interior. Like, he has everybody put in place very carefully.
Yeah.
Turns off the telegraph system for a bit so that nobody can tell anyone what's going on. There is resistance because obviously they were like, oh, come on, we just like... Did we not just do a constitution?
Yeah.
And there is this kind of attempted uprising and people put up barricades in Paris. And he just... So there's 1,200 protesters. He sends in 30,000 troops.
It seems like a little bit of an overreaction.
It is. And they somehow managed to panic. And in the process of killing 100 of those protesters, also accidentally kill 35 random bystanders. Which is a crime for which that is kind of the main thing that people who write about him in France, because he's very unpopular in France and still kind of is. Victor Hugo despises him.
Because of this, right? Like, Victor Hugo was a supporter until he did a coup.
Specifically because of this,
right? Because they had very similar politics, but then he did do a coup.
He did do a coup and he never forgives him.
Yeah.
And this, like, the Republican opposition to him, which just grows and grows and grows, really, will come back to the fact that he killed 35 people, innocent bystanders, over and over again. He does also arrest Republican leaders and Republican activists all the way across France, thousands of them. Over 20,000 people are arrested. Many of them are just deported to Algeria. Which is what they did. At one point, all of the Republican organizers in Dijon were arrested while they were waiting at the printers for their leaflets to be ready. Which I find it, like, simultaneously really terrible, because I would definitely be like one of those Republican organizers, but also kind of funny.
It's pretty funny.
Yeah. Then basically presented all of this, any resistance that occurred. So anytime there was a demonstration, he had it reported in the papers that they were just random barbarians kind of rising up and killing people as opponents to order, as kind of cruel violence, and talked about them as rapists and looters, and honestly kind of semi-familiar right-wing talking points
at
any time that there is protest. But that's how he presents it, and then he uses that to enact martial law in France. thus suspending all other law, and to institute some really intense censorship of the press, which enforces that all publications have to receive pre-authorization from the government. They have to deposit what's called caution money. So they have to put money or kind of in a government trust so that they basically prepaying fines. So if they get fined for something,
they've already, that's just taken out of their caution money.
Yeah. But basically means that they have to have many, many thousands of pounds or francs that they have to cough up front in case they in the future do a fine. So it's just basically charging people loads of money. Constant suspension of newspapers and in quite intense taxes to make newspapers more expensive as well. And then publishing their own government papers, which are significantly cheaper.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good tactic.
Yeah.
My favourite thing is that he then also held a referendum to ask people if they would chill with the coup.
Yes.
Which overwhelmingly came back yes, which it did. Is suspicious.
So he held very shortly, literally like it's the 2nd of December that he does the coup, and he called it Operation Rubicon, in case you were wondering how he felt about himself. Imagining himself very much as Julius Caesar. It was the anniversary of Austerlitz, the very famous Napoleon victory. So that's when he declared it. And on the 20th of December, he had his referendum. So very quickly. And it came back with basically 90% were in favour of the coup and thought that everybody was brilliant and that, yeah, it was great. Which is what happens when you have eliminated 30% of of the voters, and also you've arrested everyone who might vote against you or rally any kind of vote against you. So and that's how you get a 90% majority in an election. but he then can use that and be like, yeah, but you know, 90% of people agree with me, like 7,500 people voted that they should, that I should be the well, he's calling himself not the emperor yet. Got a year before he calls himself the emperor.
But basically think that I should be in charge of everything. And so that's fine, and I can do whatever I want, which he does.
And they say,
and then what
specifically,
he wants to do is kind of good.
It is martial law and the arrest of all of the opposition is what he asks them. And they say, yeah, we think it's brilliant.
Yeah.
And he then spends like 6 months ruling by edict. And this is where you get to see like what he would be if he was allowed to do whatever the fuck he liked.
Yeah.
And it's surprisingly not bad.
It's pretty great, actually. Like,
this is where the good stuff kind of happens.
Yeah, high subjectivity points for him here.
Very much so. This is where it gets good, because the first thing he does is extend the road and train networks.
Mm-hmm.
So he's immediately just gets into building.
Yeah, he's very, very concerned about how far behind the rest of Europe, and particularly England, France, is.
Yeah.
So he is like, we've got to boost our infrastructure. We've got to boost our industry to improve the economy. And he just does it. He just does that.
Yeah. He basically is like, this economy is bad and we need to fix it. And the lives of people are bad and we should make them better.
Yeah.
So he extends the road and train network. So he ends up building 29,000 kilometres of road and 13,000 kilometres of railways. He builds 3,000 kilometres of canals. He completely redoes the sewage system in Paris in order to build it into something that will massively improve public health.
Yeah, so there's clean water coming in and there's like differences between different qualities of water and what they're used for. Like the slightly dirtier water is cleaning the parks. And
yeah, he orders the destruction of the slums in Paris, which eventually will develop into basically Paris looks like it does now because Napoleon III and one of his ministers, Haussmann, built it that way, basically.
Yeah.
They very deliberately destroyed medieval Paris, destroyed the slums, and rebuilt all of its roads, built half the bridges across the Seine were built by him, all of the department stores, boulevards, parks.
Gare de Lyon and Gare du Nord railway stations were built by him.
The Opera House, the Bibliothèque Nationale, all of this, like this idea of France as a modern place with a modern city that is clean and
And massive parks as well, like four major parks and then a lot of smaller ones because he was very into Hyde Park when he lived in London and he wanted to do something similar so that there are green spaces for people to chill in.
Yes, nice. That kind of idea of being able to go outside.
Yeah.
He also confiscated all of the Orleanist estates that had been kind of stolen by the interim dictator and parcelled out amongst his family. So all of the royal estates he took back and sold them and then gave all of the money to mutual aid societies.
Mm-hmm.
Which is unusual.
Yeah.
And massively pissed off the people who were like, that's our royal property. He was like, no, I give it to the poor. He did also do the thing where he gagged the press and shut down all the cafes and arrested lots of people and also renamed the civil code the Napoleon Code.
It is, again, like, and I'm not saying that there was a right to do. Obviously, I believe in freedom of the press and freedom of speech. But, like, imagine if you were trying to do something good and the only news that was operating was, for example, Fox News. You know, if like there is a right balance, but
yes,
and it's not what he did. But also, I don't know. You've got to do something about people talking shit about nonsense. You know, I don't know what the answer is. I'm just saying you can understand if you're sitting there and you're Napoleon III and you're like, I just want to give Paris clean water, and these people keep, you know, saying I'm a shithead. I'm going to stop them saying it so I can get on with the actual things that people need.
Yeah, and you do get the feeling that he potentially continued to think that because once he started allowing debate, all of his ideas got shut down. So he tried to introduce free education. He revolutionized the education system in France and allowed kind of freedom of education.
Mm, including for women, like built loads of schools for women. His wife was very passionate about women being educated and they did a lot of, you know, for that.
Yes, and tried to introduce free education to everybody. Admittedly, the people that he let write, like, the new curricula and things, they described the aim as to be to train the child with the yoke of obedience, to create in him the principle of energy which will enable him to resist his passions and to accept of his own free will the law of labour and duty and the contract habits of order and regularity.
Yeah, that's less good.
Which is the kind of thing that sounds fucking terrifying.
Yeah.
But is... from my sociology GCSE, a general critique of formalised education. But yeah, so he tried to basically introduce free education and then with the aim of eventually making education compulsory for children. And everyone was like, no. And they wouldn't let him have that. So he does all of that in a very speedy period. And then in 1852, he has another referendum, another plebiscite, and says, would you like me to be the emperor, maybe? You know, we all like this. We all like what's going on. Would you like me to perhaps be the second Napoleon or the third Napoleon?
I'm not saying that I think I should be the emperor, but I just want to give you the opportunity to say that you think I should be.
Exactly. People have been saying it. I've heard it around. I just thought I'd let everybody share their opinion. He'd repealed the previous laws, so he'd given everybody back, or all the men back, their vote. And so overwhelmingly, another kind of 80-odd% victory, he was given the right to be the emperor. And so on the 2nd of December 1852, 1 year later to the day, he said, hey, I'm the emperor. And let everybody call him His Imperial Highness Emperor Napoleon III, officially restoring the Napoleonic Empire. And turns out that all you need to do to have an empire is say, it's an empire now.
Mm. That's fair enough. I mean, that's a better way to make something an empire than, like, conquering other lands.
I mean, he did do that too.
Yeah.
And he did also have all of the previous lands because the French had been conquering people and brutalising them for a long time.
But all
of
that stuff was still in place when he was the president. And it doesn't seem like it was hugely relevant in him getting the title of emperor again.
No, it wasn't. It is entirely a kind of honorary, like, basically saying, monarchy,
yeah,
rather than anything else, because he's inherited a lot of places. Algeria is obviously the main one that he goes to a couple of times, and depending on what book you read about him depends on how they feel about his behavior there, because he does repress the Berbers, but he also keeps turning up and saying, I don't know that repression is the way to go. But he's only 50%, I would say, interested in Algeria.
He really is just someone who does believe in democracy and the rule of the people, but he also just thinks that everyone should recognise that he is right and he should get to do whatever he wants.
I'm like, I love listening to your opinions when they agree with me. If they don't agree with me, I will arrest you and put you in prison. But when you agree with me, I love hearing all about it. And that's kind of how he goes for like the first 10 years of the empire. He has this very strong belief that governments govern and that he needs to be like the guiding hand at the center. And he is constantly there rebuilding Paris and getting involved in things. And he gives himself basically total control over everything. And there are two legislative houses, an upper house and a lower house, mm-hmm. who basically exist to ratify whatever he has done. So they're elected. Well, the upper house is elected by him. The lower house is elected by vote. So you get to have a kind of election every so often, but they don't really have any. They're not allowed to debate. They're not allowed to propose amendments. They're just sort of there and give their formal double thumbs up to everything that he says.
Yeah.
But it seems that his aim and what he does over time is he thinks that when he has stabilized everything and when everybody agrees that he is the best and when he has shown everybody that his ideas are brilliant, that they will all agree and then he'll be able to let people have some liberty.
Yeah. He and I would rule in a similar way. I feel like that's the danger of me as well. It'd be like, we just wait it out until they see that everything I've done is good and right and correct. And then
when they see how well it's going, yeah. And it was going quite fairly well, like economy like really improves. He is able to sell himself as the savior of France, the savior of society, because all of these banking institutions open up. They start doing loads of trade with like America and Britain.
Yeah,
and
he's like lowered the tariffs on imports so that deliberately to encourage local competition, right? Industry in France is kind of forced to step up its game because now they have to compete with imports, which again spurs on the French economy more. He does all sorts of stuff like that. And there's the thing that I liked a lot where I didn't know this had been a thing, but people have work cards to show that they can work and he outlaws employers tampering with those cards because previously employers could just take them or like write on them, this guy sucks, and stop that person from getting another job somewhere else. And he outlaws all of that. Like he is very practically minded in like what needs to happen to make the French industry lift up to the point where it can properly support the French populace. And, like, you can't really argue with it.
But it's not hugely, like, when he first proposed having a trade deal with Britain, the French basically told him to go fuck himself because they're like, we're not talking to those guys.
Yeah.
like, absolutely. Like, you want us to deal with the British? Are you off your head? But he eventually managed to persuade them to do it. But they did not love doing it.
No.
And obviously they don't like anybody who is around them. What brings him down really is his foreign policy. But gradually he thinks that people will see how brilliantly he's done and be like, yeah, you're the best. You saved us. You're our wise and benevolent patriarch and we will continue to vote for you. And so in about 1860, he starts kind of liberalizing. So allows people to have debates in Parliament and lets them have a little bit of control over budgets and lets people publish debates about things so they can have politics back again, and clearly thinks like, oh my god, I've done so brilliantly, everybody is going to be so impressed that they're just, all the debates are just going to be like, how do we do the emperor's brilliant ideas rather than are the emperor's ideas that brilliant at all.
Mm-hmm.
Massively undermining people who hate agreeing. where he really fucks up is the foreign policy, because he seems to believe that as the heir of Napoleon, he can therefore take Napoleon's deeply unpopular and quite unsuccessful position as arbiter of European politics. And that he will be able to roll up in any given room and be like, I can solve this.
Yeah.
if you just all do as I say, then everything will be brilliant, which means that he just gets involved in loads of conflicts that he almost didn't need to be involved in. He invades Rome at one point. He gets involved in a war with the Dutch, which goes badly. He's very bad at war.
It's very interesting, all the sorts of the bits about doing wars, because so often it's just like, these people felt like they needed to do a war, so they did one. And it's like, but why? And I mean, part of it is like massive, complicated sort of national identity stuff, right? Because this is a period where European countries are coming into being, and they're changing from being empires or collections of city-states into being nationalized. And that's quite a painful process, and it leads to all of these tensions with, like, who are you allying with? Are you allying with, you know, the remaining regions that are, you know, nationally related to you, or with someone next door who is more powerful? You know, it's very, there's a lot going on. But
And on mainland Europe, there's a whole lot going on between who owns what bit of land. With the Austro-Hungarian Empire, the Prussians are coming into being.
Yeah.
Italy is coming into being. There are a lot of battles around unification of countries and people gathering power, and who owns this little bit of Austria and who owns this little bit of France.
Yeah.
And because he thinks he's brilliant, Napoleon III launches himself into as many of them as he possibly can. and largely fucks them up.
Yeah.
Largely does not go very well at all. Although, well, he did gain Nice, I believe.
He did.
Became France because of him. But he basically really wanted to prove that France was still a global player, that it wasn't, you know, it used to be that France made the world in its own image, and it was this huge European power, and everybody had to revolve around what the French king felt. And then after Napoleon, that just has not been true. And everybody has just been ignoring France and letting them do their own weird little thing while they have twiddle twaddle, like they have revolved around him, and Austria and the Dutch and Britain have become these powers that seem to overshadow France. So he does not like, and he kind of keeps launching himself into rooms, and he's quite into the idea of everybody. I think he would be quite into the EU.
Yeah.
He's very into this idea of a European conference where all of the leaders can get around and just talk their ideas out and then agree with Napoleon III. But he seems to believe that that should be possible, and that he should be the guy that arranges that. And it just pisses people off, and it keeps kind of humiliating them on the world stage. And every time they are kind of humiliated, there are revolts or protests in France. And then as he has gradually loosened his dictatorial grip and has allowed newspapers and has allowed debates and gradually allowed people to be part of opposition parties and has given people the right to be an opposition, those protests grow and grow. And he starts losing elections. He never loses any elections, but he starts losing his super majorities in elections. He stops getting 85% of the vote and starts getting 65% of the vote.
Yeah.
55% of the vote. Like, he also is super ill after about 1860. He has gout. He has kidney stones that eventually kill him and some kind of kidney disease. He has all kinds of stomach problems and illnesses that mean that he massively loses his personal grip on what is going on. But that's also what he's specifically doing. Like, he thinks that he will be able to let go and people will continue, like having like trainer wheels on a bike, that he will be able to take those off and everybody will keep going. Like, he let them, and they don't. They're like, fuck you, we hate you, can't believe you put me in prison.
Because this is the problem. People people are still going to be
like
people.
They don't like being put in prison.
They don't like being put in prison. They don't like being told what to do. Like, it is the inherent problem is that you can't persuade people to believe even what is right. Like, even if it's there's very little argument against a certain policy, you can't just persuade people into it because we don't function like that.
No. No, we don't. Yeah. People love to argue. And people have different ways of looking at the world, and you can't just bully them into agreeing. Napoleon III was right. It all ends because of two massive foreign policy disasters. The first is the genuinely madcap and bizarre invasion of Mexico.
Yeah. Unhinged.
Which is truly unhinged. And it comes about because Napoleon III seems to think that as well as being the arbiter of Europe, he should also be the European power and reassert European power in the Americas, and that the best way to do that is to invade Mexico. Mexico at the time is being run by a US-backed Mexican government, the Benito Juarez government. Mm-hmm. It had gained independence in 1821 from the Spanish Empire, and had then been invaded in the 1840s by the Americans when they kind of lopped off a bit and called it America, mm-hmm. and was now being run by this American-backed Mexican Republic by Benito Juarez. It seems to have come about because some Mexican monarchists turned up in France and somehow persuaded Napoleon III that if he invaded Mexico, there were loads of people there who were desperate for the Europeans to come back and who hated the Americans and really wanted European power back, mm-hmm. which was not true. but this somehow gave Napoleon III this idea that he would be able to invade Mexico, be welcomed with open arms, and then would be able to place a European power there that would grow and would check the growing power of the USA. Hmm. So they've had their revolution. They are, you know, starting to be a country of global importance, that it would be able to check that American power and reassert the importance of Europe in that part of the world.
Yeah.
What happens instead is that he turns up, he sends like a kind of distant cousin called Maximilian, who is the brother of the Austrian emperor. He sends him with a French army. They invade Mexico. It takes like 2 years for them to defeat the Juarez government. It turns out that nobody wanted them at all. except approximately 17 Mexican monarchists, who Maximilian immediately alienates by not ruling as they want him to, with kind of an aristocratic hierarchy, but with some surprisingly liberal, like old school liberal workers' rights stuff. Which just enormously upsets them. And so after quite a brutal fight to power, he lasts 3 years before being overthrown. They managed to get in almost only exclusively because at the time America is fighting its civil war. Mm-hmm. And when its civil war ends in 1865, they just start throwing money back behind Juarez and turn around and are like, you know, we can't have the Europeans in Mexico, in North America. And so they start throwing money and troops back to Juarez, who overthrows Maximilian, has him executed for being a dick. Yes. And the Monroe Doctrine, as it's called, which is no Europeans in North America, is reasserted, maintaining American influence in Mexico. Mexicans seem to have little to no say in any of this.
Yeah.
But that is a disaster. And Napoleon III knows it almost immediately. He's forced into agreeing to support Maximilian for 3 years. But as soon as that 3 years are up, he starts putting his guys on boats and bringing them back to France and leaving him with like 12 sticks and a pigeon to to fight the Americans. So that's a disaster. It just goes horribly wrong. Like, this was a big publicized invasion of Mexico. He was supposed to be liberating Mexico. Went horribly wrong.
Yeah.
And then he double fucks it up by getting into a war with the Prussians.
Yeah.
Which you don't get into a war with the Prussians. Don't go into a land war in Asia. Don't get into a war with the Prussians.
Which really does seem to have been just like, he got played.
He got played.
He got ultra played around the Franco-Prussian War.
Yeah, basically the Prussians wanted to put in a Habsburg guy into Spain. He thought that he would be surrounded. He decided to get like a bit Billy Big Bollocks and be like, you can't do this to me. And the Prussians were like, yeah, we can. So he said, okay, well, we'll have a war about it. And Bismarck said, okay, I'll defeat you, and did.
I don't know how to pass possible motivations, but like I read some claims that he had a war with Austria, and then he was like, then we'll do a war with France, and then everyone will know that I'm the biggest boy in Europe. And he just like twisted French ideals to that end. Like he made people take to the streets in France demanding war with Prussia to assert their patriotism, you know.
Yeah, be like, you can't let the Prussians embarrass us like this.
Yeah.
And Bismarck was like,
yeah. It played right into my hands.
Exactly. Like a very Mr. Burns of him.
Yeah.
So he, basically pressures Napoleon into declaring war on Prussia, immediately defeats him. And defeats him to the extent that he captures Napoleon III at Sedan, dethroning him, making him a prisoner of war. And then after they keep him as a prisoner of war for like a year, and then they get bored of him, and then they send him to England to make the English look after him.
Yep.
And he spends the rest of his life kind of twirling around in a chair in Chislehurst. In a nice mansion. They give him, like, this is the thing that, like, the English are always so obsessed with the idea of nobility that it doesn't matter what you do. Like, if you come from high birth, they'll give you a mansion. So they put him in Camden House in Chislehurst, which is lovely. And he, spends the rest of his life twirling around in a chair, twiddling his thumbs, grumping that nobody agreed with him, and watching the French descend into civil war and monstrous slaughter.
Yeah.
That is the Third Republic. And goes badly.
Yeah. Which might have been felt a bit vindicating.
I suspect I imagine that he sat in France going, I knew this would happen. I told you this would happen. Like, the Paris Commune has gone horrifically badly. There's people being slaughtered in the streets. If only you had just listened to me and my brilliant ideas and let me be in charge of everything, then this... Do you know who was never slaughtered? Well, some people were slaughtered, but
only 35.
A small number of people were slaughtered, but in comparison...
It just honestly, like, the current political... My faith in democracy has taken a real hit over the last 15 years. And I just, you know, I get it. I do.
Yeah. There is a time when you're like, maybe the philosopher kings... You're benevolent dictators, right up until you're the point where you are the person that the dictators are coming for.
Yeah.
He does get... There was a period in like mid-20th century historiography where people called him like the precursor to Mussolini and Hitler, and saw him as a proto-fascist dictator, which he's not really, because he very voluntarily goes out of his way to say, you know, I'm doing this temporarily, and then he does give people back rights.
Yeah, yeah. I think genuinely believed all he needed to do was prove that his ideas were correct.
Yeah.
And then people would recognise his authority naturally without him having to demand it of them. But yeah,
he was wrong about that.
He just was wrong about that.
And he did not realise that when you do repress people, you do enormously piss them off.
Yeah.
And they will come back and fight you. Making enemies is not a good idea if you want everybody to agree with you. Much as the way you can't bomb your way to peace, you can't repress yourself to democracy.
You can't.
But yeah, so that's Napoleon III.
Yeah.
I'd say medium dick. I wouldn't want to live under him, I don't think. And I think that he would probably be quite frustrating.
I think I'd be okay with it because I wouldn't disagree. Like,
you would disagree with him. You'd be like, fuck the Republicans.
Yeah, I'm really glad to have this beautiful park now. I think it is good that workers have more rights.
I mean, he did also brutally repress some strikes. He like made it illegal to strike, and then anytime anybody went on strike, he sent in the army. It was like, obviously.
He didn't make it illegal to strike. He made it illegal to strike. It had been illegal, and he made it legal.
Yes.
But because he just didn't quite ever practice what he preached. His beliefs were constantly being tested by the realities of what people do, which is where he really falls down.
Yeah. There's a great episode of Battlestar Galactica about that, where in season 3, when the miners go on strike and they have to reckon with the fact that they really need those miners on the basis that they are like 12 ships in a war, but at the same time they totally have the right to strike. And it's an unanswerable question, you know. There is no ideal perfect response to anything.
No. And like, this is one of the things I think about, like when I in the Dark Nights of the Soul, where I think about how the world is terrible, because I don't think we have functioning democracy really. And one of the things that I think you need in order to have functioning democracy is consequences for politicians who mislead voters, right? That seems like a pretty crucial core component that we currently don't have. But you have to get people to agree to that. And for people to agree, politicians have to stop lying so that they can't mislead voters about that. Like, it's very difficult to see a path to achieving an actual democratic system that works.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's very tempting to be like, well, we'll just do it with authoritarianism in the short term.
Yeah. We'll just crush you until you stop it.
Crush you. And then once you've recognised that we were right all along.
Yeah. If only people would recognise that you and me, Janina, were right all along.
Yeah.
Mostly, and I want to really emphasise this, about the fact that films should not be 3 hours long. The most important crisis confronting the world today, I would say, is 3.5 hour long films. And one day, when people elect me president and then I overthrow myself to become emperor, I will stop it. My single platform. Actually, no, I have two platforms. I introduced a new one recently, which is mandatory retail and or food service work for all people for 6 months.
Yes, yes. Across the Christmas period.
Yes, at Christmas, you deal with the public and then you'll probably behave better.
Yeah.
So that's Napoleon, Janina.
Yeah.
Napoleon III, who's really Napoleon II, since Napoleon II isn't real.
Yeah.
What are we going to talk about next time?
So next time we're going to talk about my top 3 shipwrecks.
Yeah.
Of all time.
We have a question from S. San Rudiani, who said, please tell us about Janina's favourite shipwrecks, ? So it counts as a question because they put a question mark in.
I think I'd like just dropped an allusion to one of my top 3. And so he's asked about all of them.
So yes. So Janina's going to tell us about her favourite shipwrecks. Yep. And I'm going to try and think of a good one just to join in.
Yeah. That'll be fun.
Yeah. And until then, you can find us in places. At historyofsexy.com. All the things are there.
Yeah, there's links to our social accounts, and there's a form you can fill in to ask a question, and there is merch, and you can support us and all those lovely things.
Yes, you can send us some money and buy us a coffee if you would like to. I'm going to specifically say thank you to everybody who has signed up to support us monthly, which we hugely appreciate. And I have had some stickers made to send to people. So if you support us monthly, then you should have an email from me about whether you would like some stickers or not, and that I will send to you. I have 10 stickers left. So the first 10 people to sign up after this will also get a sticker as a monthly person. These are slightly smaller than I thought they were going to be. So these are limited edition and no one will ever get them again. And next lot will be different. So I'm going to say we have new people. So we have Theo GB. Theo has always given us money every time we release an episode and has now signed up to be a monthly person.
Well, thank you, Theo.
So thank you, Theo. Yeah. I was going to send you a sticker anyway because I appreciate you. Liz Edwards, Anna Paredes, Nathan Redland are all new. And Bevan is also new. And I think I said thank you to everybody else previously. But thank you all. Everybody.
Yeah, thank you.
And yeah, if you sign up in the next, I don't know, if you're one of the next 10, you'll get a sticker. And an email from me.
Which is probably even better.
I mean, no, sure it is. Yeah. I love emails. So.
Yeah, everyone just loves always getting
emails.
Everyone
loves it when they receive an email. So. Yeah, so thank you very much. And is that it?
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah. Bye, Janina.
Bye.